Hey, welcome everybody. It's No Driving Gloves. If you're on the live stream on YouTube, hello, I'm glad you're joining us. I accidentally put the time a little bit wrong, so we're going to kind of tread some water here, talk a little bit about tariffs, talk about Malibus, talk about cars for the first few minutes. And then Derek and I promised we will bring you our worst. And last week's podcast was horrible, but I re-released it in a much edited, cleaned up fashion. So if you it was unlistenable to you and you had to abandon and jump ship, which I know some people did, it's all fixed. Go download the re-release. Actually, if you're a subscriber, it downloaded for you already on the audio podcast video. I'm sorry. We got to live with it. How are you doing?
I'm doing good, John. So are you saying that you cleaned up last week's podcast, so it's now the John edition? Isn't that when you take something back and make it your own again, you have to name it after yourself?
I actually just deleted all of you. And like I said, it took it from like an hour 28 to an hour. So yeah, just exactly. Me talking. No, we had some weather issues and oh, I'm sorry that I even released that. But I promised we'd bring you our worst. We brought you our worst last week. This week, there was some news announced. We're going to try to change up a couple of the sections here, too, for our long-term listeners. Let's see if you notice. Derek, what kind of car do you drive?
John, I drive a Chevrolet Malibu.
Oh, so you've fallen victim to my Fiesta Taurus fusion syndrome when GM announced the death of the Malibu after what is it 60 years?
It's got to be close to that. Let's see, 64 to 2024 would be 60 years.
We've touched on this in previous episodes, and General Motors' excuse is nobody buys cars anymore. Now, Ford did this a few years ago and killed all of the cars in their lineup. And the dealer and I were talking, I guess when I bought my Fiesta about a year and a half ago, and the salesman said, nah, I think Ford's bringing back some cars. And it just kind of caught me that General Motors is, nobody's buying cars, so we're going to go ahead and eliminate this from our, which I can't remember if that leaves any cars in General Motors lineup.
Well, it really doesn't, because they're killing the Camaro as well.
Yeah, at least Ford, when they killed the cars, they kept the Mustang around. Chrysler division of Stellantis or Dodge division or whatever. They killed off all of their cars now. And I can't remember, is the new, the Charger's coming back. So they're bringing back a car and in 2 and 4 door fashion.
Now there is talk that the Camaro is going to be coming back as an electric car, but I don't think there's anything definitive yet.
Yeah. But with the way EVs are going and, Ford's cut massive chunks out of their EV lineup, and they came out a week or two ago and said what are they losing $100,000 a car after all development costs, etc., put in. I would think that might push the Camaro back a little bit, or at least that thinking on the Camaro. But as we've said before, we sell a lot of cars in this country. I think car sales constitute about 30% of all, consumer level purchases, being cars, SUVs, light trucks. That's still a pretty substantial number. And, Honda doesn't seem to have a problem selling Civics and Accords. They're everywhere. The Camry's like still the second best selling Toyota, it's way up there in the list. The RAV4 is the best selling car. We're leaving out F-150s in that, and I think the Camry is the second. Hyundai doesn't have a problem selling the Sonata. Kia doesn't, or is it the Kia Sonata? Hyundai Sonata, Kia. Okay. Is it the Kia? I can't think of what the Kia is called.
Yeah, all I can think of right now is the Stinger, which was the fancy version of it.
But, I mean, it seems these foreign auto manufacturers don't have a problem selling cars. And then that GM announcement made me think back to, I think I've heard this. And you said you hadn't heard it either, had you, Derek?
No, this was news to me this evening.
Yeah, that in January of this year, Jim Farley, CEO of Ford, had announced the return of four car models. The Capri, Ford Capri, the Ford Taurus, the Lincoln Continental, and the Ford Thunderbird. So they're going to be electric and hybrid and all of that, which that's just the way cars are now. I think we just have to bite our lips and live with it or take it as it is, you know, but we'll see. But Ford's bringing back cars. So my salesman was right a year and a half ago that was a mistake to eliminate all the cars from your lineup. Because I like driving a car on a daily basis. 07 Dodge Ram, was that the last truck I owned? I did have that little Mazda SUV in there, I guess. But primarily drive cars on a daily basis. I don't know. I don't see a need for a truck. And, you know, my little Festiva, and it's 40 miles a gallon, or Fiesta, does exactly what I need it to do. And I keep thinking, oh, well, maybe a Maverick or maybe a Bronco Sport. Or I don't want to give up the gas mileage. And frankly, with the exception of a clearance freezer and a clearance pizza oven, I've been able to put everything in it that I've ever wanted to. So that was just the one thing that surprised me, that the Malibu is going away. So if you're in the market for a Malibu, probably should rush out and get yours today.
I'm just happy I'll have a collector piece, right? I mean, I'll have a car that's no longer made, the Malibu. Actually, two, because I have the 66 Malibu convertibles. We got two Malibus in the family, and they're now true collector pieces because they're not made anymore. I like it. Right, John. I think you're right. I mean, most people like driving cars, and the gas mileage that cars get over trucks. I mean, yeah, there's a big sector of America and the American public that like having trucks. I mean, I'm at heart a truck guy. I've had a lot of trucks in my life. I'm currently on the hunt for a new truck. That is one of the things I'm doing.
Last week you were talking about going ahead and getting a V10 Excursion. So to hell with the gas mileage.
Maybe, I don't know. We'll see. Maybe we might go for something a little more gas mileage friendly. Like, I don't know, one of those Eco Boosts that were around for a while. I think a lot of us said this when the announcements were made from, you know, big three, the auto industry at the time, the American auto industry, when they came out and said, you know, we're not going to build cars anymore. You know, Ford was the first to do it. And I think a lot of people were like, what are you doing? Like, this is, what do you mean no one buys cars anymore? Go drive to a parking lot in town, a Walmart parking lot, a Target parking lot, a whatever parking lot, and look around. There's all kinds of cars. People still drive cars. People still own cars. So where the American auto industry got this idea that the car market sales, and maybe, the point was their car sales were slumping because they were building cars that people didn't feel were up to the quality of the foreign cars, the cars that were being imported into this country. And so I think it was a saving face of saying, well, people don't buy. Well, no, people aren't buying American cars that don't stand up to the quality and the, get the fuel economy and the things that the, Toyotas and the Hondas and the Hyundais and all of those were turning out. People were going for those because they were a little more affordable. They got better gas mileage. They had a little better quality. And the American auto industry, it's pretty par for the course. You got to think back. It's par for the course through history for the American auto industry to do stuff like this. I mean, the biggest thing that I think blows my mind from American automotive history is the transition from muscle car era. Of course, we hit the OPEC crisis, gas, you know, the gas crisis, all the things that were going on in the mid-1970s, you know, smog control, all of that. Okay, well, we got to figure out a way to, you know, get fuel economy and do all this and clean the cars up. So we're going to build, we're going to look at building small cars like the Vega and these and the Mustang II, and we're really going to clean things up. And then things get a little better in the 80s, and then all of a sudden we get the Olds Delta 88s and the giant Lincoln Continental. We just take this about face of, okay, well, we got past that. Let's build giant land yachts now. How do you convince yourself as a company that that's the right way to go? This is one of those things that it seems like history repeating itself, where it's like, we're not paying attention to what's actually happening. And so we're just going to say that this is what's happening.
As I said to you in the pre-show, I spend a lot of time in parking lots and looking around. And yes, no doubt about it, SUVs dominate parking lots. Pickup trucks, a close second. But there are cars out there. And I'd say 30% of the stuff out there is cars. And pick a Walmart or, like you said, a Target parking lot or your local grocery store. But then look at the cars and look at the SUVs and the pickups. A lot of those are new. The cars are older because the selection new out there is rough. And, you know, am I going to pay $30,000 for a brand new Malibu when I can buy one 2 or 3 years old for 20 or 17, you know, half the money, 2, 3 years old? Maybe that's a problem. The car manufacturers, we're not selling any new ones. Well, that's because let's look at the used car market and the number of them trading hands in the used car market among people. And, you know, I wanted a car. I had to buy a used, you know, a used car. My girlfriend, her car was purchased used because of the savings there. You know, it just gets me that American manufacturers don't think cars are viable. And we haven't even touched on the European cars that are available. It seems Mercedes does a pretty good job selling a lot of cars, and so does Audi, and so does BMW. There was major, major EV news this week, Derek.
I heard.
Our president, Joe Biden, stepped up, and in order to help ensure a greener economy or a greener world and help the UAW maintain jobs and production, he quadrupled the tariff on electric vehicles coming from China. Went from a 25% tariff, which has done a very good job of deterring these cars from coming here. It's one of these stupid tariffs. He quadrupled that to 100%. Chinese aren't bringing electric cars over here at 25%. You really think they're going to bring them over here at 100%? I heard a reviewer, or read about a reviewer who actually sampled a Chinese electric car that sells for $10,000 US from China in China, heavily subsidized, et cetera, and that's why we put this tariff on, because China could sell these cars here 10 grand a piece, and just dominate the market, have to sell them for 20. But there's a, we talked about it a few episodes ago, maybe actually a few months ago, and China in EVs. And guess what? China's building factories in Mexico. Do you know what the tariff is to bring a car under, quote, NAFTA-ish. I know NAFTA's changed and it's was reworked under the Trump administration. But do you know what the tariff is to bring a car in from Mexico? Doesn't matter where the parent company's based. If the car's built in Mexico, you want cost to bring it into this country?
I believe, isn't that standing right around 2.5% right now, John? Something like that?
Exactly. Why do you think China has been building factories in Mexico and selling electric cars in Mexico? They saw this coming. You know, they were doing it to get around the 25%. I think they were doing a slow introduction. But if I was China, I'd kind of say, F you, America. We're going to go ahead and bring our cars there now. Why we can do it at 2.5 and, you know, really rub it into the wounds. Because either $20,000 that we build it in China and send it over, or $10,250 if we build it in Mexico and send it over. It looks really good on paper. And if we really cared about the environment and the green movement, would we really be taxing these vehicles at such outrageous rates when they're from what I read, they're quality vehicles, kind of dependable, and they would give the stuff that we're making here a run for the money. And a couple articles I read as I was kind of researching this little segment, they would put Tesla to shame for their build quality. And we know that Teslas have some build issues and could be in real trouble in the next couple of weeks. I don't know. I really want to do this other podcast, and I've talked to Derek off air about it and that. And this is one of these things. Oh, we'll grab the headline, 100% tariff. None of the Chinese EVs that show up here are going to be built in China. They're going to be built south of the border.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's like you said, John. Yeah, we try not to get political on this show, even though it is No Driving Gloves. But it goes back to exactly what you said when you introduced this topic, which is there was already a 25% tariff on these vehicles. So China was not sending them to the U.S. Why do we need to put 100% tariff on? They are not coming here. It is simply a dog and pony show of, well, look what we're doing. We're putting a tariff of 100% on these cars that weren't coming here. Okay, cool. You didn't do anything. Like, what? And to your point, John, what exactly are we doing this for? Because if we are trying to build the electric vehicle market and make a greener technology, you know, or have greener technologies in this world, like you said, we're blocking China from sending stuff here that might actually be better quality than some of ours that, I don't know, we could learn from, we could study, we could understand. Yeah, it's all very strange what is going on in the world right now. And this is just one of those things that makes you wonder, what exactly are we doing?
Like you say, we try not to get too political, and we try to avoid the politicalness of the world. I'm not doing this to be political. I'm not doing this to speak against Biden. I'm just doing this to say, always got to watch behind the curtain. You never know what they're doing.
Exactly.
Now that we've covered a bit of news, I think it's time to give you our worst. I don't know, to any of the listeners out there in Podlandia listening to No Driving Gloves, have a suggestion on what are some of the worst cars ever made? With no criteria, because I guess you don't need criteria when you're making these lists.
No, you don't, John. No criteria, no rubric, no qualifications, no anything.
It is tough coming up with the worst, I guess, when you know your cars and you can go, well, I could say this was the worst, but it caused this, it caused this, it caused this. K-Car. absolutely one of the worst cars ever made. But it saved Chrysler. So does that make it the worst car? It was obviously a pretty good car when they were selling them. You know, history doesn't look kindly on them, but it saved a company. It made Lee Iacocca famous. It allowed Chrysler to pay off their first government bailout, second government bailout, 2.5, 3 years early. So I can't put that as one of the worst cars because of what it created and what it caused. And a lot of those, I say early, I mean, just because it's a bad car doesn't make it the worst car. You know, when I want to know the worst car, I want to know the worst car, a car that was built with no redeeming qualities. Pinto wasn't bad, Jason. The Gremlin wasn't bad.
Exactly. The Pinto they weren't the worst, John. They weren't great. They had some bad features, bad qualities, right? And that you're going exactly down the track I've been thinking about for the last week since we did last week's episode, thinking about this episode tonight. And it is exactly that. The vehicles that were on the list that we went over last week, if you didn't listen, go back, listen to last week's, stop here, we'll wait. And then listen to us from here on out. But a lot of those cars had bad things about them, maybe a bad feature or some bad, but the overall car.
Or they just created the car and the popularity of the gasoline motor.
Well, you know, something small. But, you know, to call something the worst, I mean, it's got to be overall terrible. And yeah, you know, one of the things I did think about over the last week is that there is one car on the list that he put, you know, fairly early in the list. He kind of went chronologically. He went up through the decades, if you will. But he did put on this list from last week the Buckminster Fuller Dymaxion car. And I will say the Dymaxion car probably comes close to being one of the worst cars ever built. Buckminster Fuller had an interesting idea behind what he was attempting to do, but the car was tragically flawed. The design of the car was tragically flawed. And they built three of these vehicles, and two of them were completely destroyed in car accidents that led to deaths of people. That's why I say they were tragically flawed, because people died that they probably didn't need to. Just the overall engineering of the car, there's some really, really bad things going on. I will actually agree with the Dymaxion car possibly being, well, very likely being one of the 50 worst cars ever built. That one actually does come pretty close for me to being a worst car. Yeah, I have one in mind that I'm going to save to a little later that I want to talk about. But that's kind of where I was headed, John, is that exact thing. Like, to be the worst, it can't just have one bad feature. It can't, you know, the Pinto, you know, okay, the gas tank was in a bad place and, you know, bad things would happen in car accidents. Same thing with the Chevrolet trucks that had the gas tank mounted behind the seat. In the back of the cab, and you'd get in an accident in, you know, just the right location in the truck, and bad things happen in the accident. But that's one design flaw. That's one engineering flaw. It's a bad thing, but I don't feel like it makes the vehicle one of the worst in history.
No, I mean, you can look at some of that stuff. I mean, the square-bodied Chevys had the gas tanks on the outside of the frame rail. So when I owned my square body Chevy, there was a big lawsuit, and I think I got $250 or something because I owned one of these trucks. The Pinto, I've always defended. The Pinto would have never happened in today's world because the flaw with the Pinto wasn't where the gas tank was located. I mean, look at the, I'm going to just do this to irritate Derek. Look at the 64 and a half Mustang. And the gas tank was part of the trunk floor.
The Falcon was, my Falcon is that way, Of course, that's what the Mustang's made up of.
The reason the Pinto failed and had those explosive news stories was there were a series of screws that came through the floor of the hatch area that were approximately 1 inch longer than they needed to be. And they would shear the gas tank open in that rear end collision, which then of course would spill fuel and create vapors and create the explosion. In today's world, the bean counters wouldn't have let those screws be that much too long. You know, the screws need to be two threads longer than the nut. And that's it, because it would save weight and it would save cost on the material. So I don't think, the people think it's because of where the gas tank was. It's not where the gas tank it was. It's what was surrounding the gas tank created the big issue, because gas tanks were mounted behind the rear axle in front of the rear bumper for the longest time. Now, of course, they're sent more centrally located under the back seat of your car, below the steel floor, and composite, all this other stuff. But the Pinto, I never think of it as too bad. I don't think I would ever own one or drive one. And Jason seems to be stuck on the Pacer, the Pinto, and the Gremlin. You know, let's get out of the mid-70s. I mean,
yeah, I think he just doesn't like the subcompact 70s era, weird styled cars. That's,
and next thing he's going to be is the Honda CVCC. Yeah. Now, one that I thought of, and I can't think of any redeeming value. It's sold in decent quantities. When's the last time you saw one? When's the last time you thought of one? There is one in some of the early episodes of Seinfeld in the opening scenes. The Ford Tempo. It wasn't a horrible car, but it's a forgotten car. It has no redeeming quality about it. Can you tell me any one redeeming quality about the Tempo? They sold them in two-door. They sold them in four-door. My dad's business owned two because the Chrysler dealer pissed him off, and he drove over to the Ford dealer and bought two Tempos. And it just was a car. I mean, it didn't do anything well. It didn't do anything horrible. It just, see, to me, that would fall into, it's a forgotten car.
It's forgotten, but is it the worst, or is it because we don't have a rubric or qualifications that a forgotten car can be the worst?
Well, I use the rubric on the worst cars is cars that are not remembered. See, I would argue your Dymaxion. Yeah, it was a horrible car. It killed people, but it was part of a design evolution and experiment of the era when you had the Stout Scarab. And I would even put the Chrysler Airflow and in kind of that. They were looking for these aerodynamic things and trying to be efficient with space. And precursors to the minivan, mm-hmm. Bucky just thought he could do it with three wheels. And that was probably the biggest design flaw with the car. I mean, you obviously have experienced one. I don't know if you've ever driven the one that's available to you, reproduction that it is. And if I remember having a conversation with the owner, he said that they did do some improvements to maybe make it a little bit more stable, but that could be just my old age in memory. You could answer that question better.
No, it has had some re-engineering done of the steering, and it's still terrible. Have not driven it yet. It gets out every now and then, just not that frequently. It's just bad. I don't know what else to say. I will agree. It is a period of time where there's a lot of experimenting going on. There are those ideas of making use of space, but it makes terrible use of the space, in my opinion. And it's just, It was just bad. Anyway, moving on.
Jason just must be reading this article because all three of his initial, the Pacer, the Gremlin, the Pinto, are on the Time article. And according to the Time article from 2017, a recent poll by Hagerty Insurance asked enthusiasts to name the worst car design of all time. And the Glasline Bolus of Dorkiness is the pathetic winner, being the AMC Pacer. I never thought Pacers were ugly. And then it goes on to Chrysler Crossfire. I think Chrysler Crossfire, when it was sold, was the best Mercedes SLK hardtop you could buy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of like the Cadillac XLR. It's kind of forgotten. But again, it was the best retractable hardtop Corvette you could buy. It was there, but it just slightly missed the mark. And the Chevy SSR, I think you're going to find these cars are going to come around and come in, especially the later ones with the 5.7s and stuff. I think those cars are going to hang around a while. I think they're going to become collectible, kind of like we talked about it briefly. Well, you talked about it. I was having internet issues at the time. The Pontiac Aztec. I liked the Aztec when it first was debuted. I liked it when it was on the market. It was not the best car in the world. It was ugly. They've refined that over the years, but it introduced a whole new class of cars. It created the, what do you want to call it? The Porsche Cayenne Fastback. It created these BMW M SUVs with the sloped rear ends. And it created this four-door sport coupe SUVs, whatever you want to call them. It invented that class.
Mm-hmm.
It just had a funny little look. When, you could go and people will say it. And I know the BMW 7 Series is on this list, but the Chris Bangle BMWs take a lot of crap for being so ugly in the trunk. And that was a horrible design. And Bangle got, he's not in the automotive industry now. I can't remember what he designs, but he's got his own design firm and does not do cars anymore. But if you look, the BMW did it, but they didn't do it quite right. But if you start looking at the S classes from like 2 years later, 3 years later, your S550s and that, they all had that trunk lid, then a little step down to the rear fender, and then the rear fender curved off. They just figured out how to soften the line a little. Bangle, to me, came up with that style. It just needed refinement. And that's a lot of things. The first edition of something isn't necessarily bad or the worst or horrible. It just needs a little bit of refinement, a little bit of tuning. And your focus group goes from 100 people from 5 people to 20 people to 100 people to the entire population. And when the entire population starts weighing in, these designers and engineers can start going, you're right. We never thought of that, or we never thought of this. I talked last week about Colin Chapman using the general public as his R&D department. General public is always an R&D department. That's why I have a hard time with this list with, like you say, no criteria, no rubric behind it, no qualifications. Because, a lot of these cars here, worst car design of all time, okay. AMC Pacer. That one, in its description, gives you why it's on the list. But some of these others.
Let's move on from the list, because that's what last week was about. And trying to talk more about some of the worst cars that we would pick, right, John? And you've talked a little bit about some of them. A lot of people don't like the Aztec, you're right, but there's a lot of people that really like the Aztec. Were there issues with it? Yes. But like you said, John, it carried, it brought about a new design to the world of automotive design. Now, I will say, the one thing that shocked me on the list that Now I have to go back and look before I say something that I might be mistaken about. But there was a car that was not on the list, and I'm double checking myself right now. I apologize for dragging this out, that I would not ever consider to go on the list of worst cars in history. But it surprised me that it wasn't, just because of how cliche some of this list was. A lot of people, I think, would want to add the Chevrolet Corvair to the list of worst cars. And I would not do that. I would not put the Corvair on any list of the worst cars in history. It had a flaw very early on that was fixed. And it really came down to, you know, the way GM approached Ralph Nader's attack of them that led to such the demise of the Corvair in the way it happened. But overall, the Corvair really was a pretty decent car for what they were attempting to do in competing with Volkswagen and, you know, that whole rear engine, you know, air-cooled world that was coming about in the 60s. And, you know, it shocked me that I didn't see that car on the list when I got to thinking about it. And knowing that there are people out there that would put the Corvair on a list like this, you know, but just one that I wanted to bring to the table that I would not put on the list, even though probably the bulk majority of Americans that know a little bit about automotive history, we're always kind of, I feel like, taught to believe that, oh, the Corvair was terrible. It was such a bad car. It really wasn't. They fixed the flaw, and it really was a pretty darn good car for what they were trying to turn out.
I'm sorry, I got a little distracted on this article. The picture that they used for the Pontiac Aztec is a Pontiac Vibe. They didn't even get the right car in the picture.
Nothing makes me more irritated than that. Are you serious? Let me fly down to that entry here and see. I glanced right over that because I also am one that would not put the Aztec on the list. But
and the BMW 7 Series was the O2 Chris Bangle designed one that was on the list that you brought up briefly last week. And they put it on because of the iDrive, which, guess what? I've got iDrive in the Mini. It works just fine. It just happens to be 18 years evolved, and it does a lot of things. And I would rather have iDrive than touchscreen. It's still multiple menus of BS, but...
You know what, John? I just got the Pontiac Aztec entry, and... Wow. Yeah, there is a beautiful shot of the Pontiac Vibe representing the Pontiac Aztec. This list in this article gets worse every day we look at it.
Ralph Nader was a little over the top there, Jason. I mean, he did end the tail fins and that, like on the Cadillacs. If you do read his book, it's amazing the number of people that actually died because of those that would impale themselves on the tail fins, supposedly.
I don't remember that exact part of the Nader argument, but wasn't it, I mean, Ralph Nader's big thing, and of course then the chrome pieces he would have been talking about were metal. I think he was more focused on getting rid of metal that could become very sharp and protruding in an accident in the interior more than the chrome on the interior for, you know, like blindness of the driver. I think it really came down, as I recall, more to the fact that there was so much metal in the interior that he felt was unsafe. And you got to admit, some of the metal back in the day that they were putting in the interiors, it was kind of scary.
Well, I mean, it was pointy, it was sharp, and it really wasn't chrome, it was polished stainless. Thank you, Tim. My first guy I ever worked for. It's not chrome, it's stainless. And you learned a lot of that working on 58 Impalas, which for some reason are always been a thorn in my side in my restoration career. But yeah, I mean, I think you're right there, Derek, is that his issue was more of the things were, you know, they would pop off and they'd become spears and razor blades. Been a while, and somewhere around here I do have On Safe at Any Speed, and I probably should read it again. Maybe read it out loud and make it a book on tape.
Yeah, I've been meaning to go back and reread a few books, and boy, time just escapes me. If you don't have anything really out there, John, I've brought one to the table that I want to throw out. Absolutely no one listening is probably going to know what this car is, because it is a one-of-a-kind car. And the only reason that I know its history and know of it is because, well, it's in the collections of the Lane Motor Museum. And I think most people that study the car, and there have been articles written about it, so once we bring it up, please go out, take a look, read about it, and then come to the museum and see it. Within our collection is a vehicle called the Hoffman. It is the 1951 Hoffman. That is its entire name. There's nothing else. It's one of a kind. And it is a post-World War II, obviously, 1951, German-constructed microcar, essentially. Done by a gentleman named Michael Hoffman in the Munich area of Germany. He built this thing using mostly a hardware store and junkyard parts that he was able to locate in the late 40s and early 50s. It's a three-wheeler, two wheels at front, one in the rear, so reverse trike setup. But the problem is, well, the multiple problems are, number one, the engine and transmission, the entire driveline assembly is actually mounted on the rear wheel and all of the steering control. As you turn the car and the rear wheel is the driven wheel and the steering, the weight of the engine acts as a pendulum as you're turning. So it actually shifts all of the weight of it to the side that you are turning the wheel to. So the whole thing kind of starts to tip to one side because of the shift of the weight. On top of that, the wheelbase of the car is shorter than the track of the front wheels. So in other words, the car is slightly wider at the front than it is actually long to the rear. Makes it incredibly unstable.
Well, for those of you who are actually watching the video podcast, I did pop up a picture of this. The track of the front wheels, I don't even know what to say. It's a very interesting looking vehicle. But to put it in a perspective for those that are listening to the audio podcast, think of it as we've all seen kit car Ferraris and kit car Lamborghinis and how close those Fiero-based monstrosities appear to the real or look like the real one. This would be somebody who tried to build a BMW Isetta at a Home Depot. That might be the closest thing to put a visual in your head.
It's actually, it's surprisingly, it's a little bigger than an Isetta.
Well, I'm going to say you might have to step on the Izetta so it squishes out a little. Or if you were to paint it red, put a black stripe down it and some black dots, it would be a pretty good ladybug.
Yeah, yeah. I like Jason's comment here. It looks like a football helmet, and it kind of does. But the other reason, and John, this ties right back to something you were saying earlier, is you said that all the cars you could think of, there was some kind of redeeming qualities. Put the picture back up. I want to reference some things here. And I think with the Hoffman, I don't know that there are any redeeming qualities of this vehicle. And guys, I've not had the chance to drive this car yet. This is all obviously what the staff have told me that have driven the car. Jeff Lane himself has driven the car, told me about it. The next time we have it up and running, I'm going to take it out for a spin and hopefully not a roll over. But there are other things about this vehicle. I mean, we've already went over some of the engineering flaws, but if you look at the doors and you see how high that bottom sill is and how big that rocker area is, how small the door is. And for those watching the live feed, you can see this if you're listening to the audio. When you get a chance, don't do it while you're driving. Look up a picture of this thing or come to the museum. But if you look where the front wheels are, you can imagine where the wheelhouse inside the vehicle is. It's actually in the way of part of the door. So you also don't have a lot of clearance getting into the vehicle. And once you're in, there's not a lot of room to be inside the cabin space either. So it goes so much further than the stability issues of the car, the balance issues when you're turning with the engine swinging the weight back and forth. And not only that, but you know, John, I don't know if you can find a true like front on picture of the vehicle, but it is also asymmetrical. It being hand built, although we have a lot of hand built one offs in the collection that are pretty nicely symmetrical. Mr. Hoffman evidently could not figure out how to make this vehicle symmetrical from the right to left side. So when you look at it from the front dead on, you can actually see that this vehicle is different from side to side. So going back to that redeeming qualities of the vehicle, and you know, that's what kind of can maybe make it have bad things about it, but not be the worst ever. I'm not sure there is a redeeming quality to the Hoffman. The Hoffman, in my opinion, may be one of the truly worst vehicles in history.
Well, I couldn't find that front on shot, but here's a couple more pictures from the Lane Museum. One with the door open showing that wheelhouse. And there's a few more if I can get back. I hate it when my cursor leaves me. There's where our motor is in the back and giving it a nice rump, which really does make it look like a football helmet.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, okay, then, it did have a split window, so, you know.
Hey,
go ahead.
We can kind of what?
Well, you can kind of see it in this picture. If you notice the driver's side, you can see the windshield kind of goes down at a much sharper angle at that top corner than on the right side. If you look kind of carefully off there at the in the distance, but you could just see that it just kind of the left driver's side just kind of comes down a little lower. It is a engineering marvel.
You seem to be a little bit hard on this car.
You know, here's the thing. This summer when I drive it, I'll report back on my feelings of driving it.
And you probably should talk about getting a head-on image published, because there's no head-on. I've got a perfect side image, and I got kind of a 4/5 front image, but nothing really shows that asymmetricalness. Do you know they make a die-cast?
I think we have it in the collection. We tried it. We had tried to have all of the models of the vehicles in our collection also. So,
yeah, you should have that in your gift shop.
I don't know that many of them were made, John, and I don't know that they're still being made. I think they're quite expensive.
I didn't say it has to be affordable. I mean, Jesus Christ, Barber Museum's got their men on flying naked men on wheels with wings for $5,000 in their gift shop.
Well, that's true.
And every now and then they sell one. But I don't know. I don't have an argument not to make it one of the worst cars, but I don't have an argument, you know, I don't have an argument either way. So we'll leave that one there. So, like I said, once you put that qualification on what is the worst, Jason seemed to go with style and styling. Derek went with engineering and practicality. And I went with redeeming memorable values. It really, you just can't put a list out that says the 50 worst cars and leave it there. There is a link to the list of the 50 worst cars on last week's show notes, and I will put it into this week's show notes. I will link to the Hoffman pictures at the Lane Motor Museum. So you can check that out. But now we covered the, for those that joined us late, we covered the death of the Malibu. Didn't even make it to Social Security, 2 years shy. We'd covered the Chinese EV tariffs and the smoke and mirrors distraction that is. And then, of course, we discussed some of the worst cars with some of our listeners and that. You have anything exciting going on in your car world, Derek? Or I know you do, but the announcements are coming soon. I don't.
I think we will we'll visit the news probably next Thursday on that front, John, once I get everything locked in a little bit further and know a few more of the details. So that'll be the teaser to get everybody back for next week.
Yeah, and I've just been swamped with everything. Been watching various YouTubes and trying to catch up on the car world. It's been very interesting. Have a new episode of Automobiles Alabama coming out where we talk about, we've had the discussion, and it's one of the reasons No Driving Gloves exists, about the youth getting into the hobby. And I might share some of the interviews here on No Driving Gloves, but check out Automobiles Alabama, brought to you by Mob Inc. and Maserati of Birmingham. And they, in this next episode, will have a 17-year-old business owner in the car realm. We'll talk to a 24-year-old who has owned his Camaro for 8 years, built it from a shell into a drag car, and then got bored with it and tore it apart and made it a twin turbocharged 69 Camaro, not a new Camaro. Built it, learned to weld, did everything himself, Yeah. And just talk to probably a 12-year-old who had experienced his second Ferrari Testarossa and get some of his impressions. But the youth is out there. We just have to nurture them and encourage them. And I just like to see that. That's one of the fun things I'm having about doing this new podcast for that local car club. And like I told them, I'm probably going to steal some stuff for this show, but who knows when it'll trickle over here. But check out Automobiles Alabama if you need another podcast to hear people just talk about their love of cars. So with that, I'm going to wrap it up for tonight.
And I will, as always, wind it up by saying thanks for listening tonight, for everybody that commented. Much appreciated. And guys, if you want to support the show, if you like what you hear, if you like what you see on the live feed, obviously there's the QR code here on the live feed where you can buy us a coffee, or head over to the social medias, Facebook, Instagram, all those places. Give us a like. And of course, the best thing you can do to help the show grow is get out there, share us with a friend, and help us grow. Share the show.
Yeah, that's where you were going. And as I always say, we've concluded for the evening. So now, get off your ass, go burn some gas, because the John and Derek are out. If I can push the buttons.